There's a place where dreams are born. It's across the sea and through the storm. Now listen, come with me to this magic hour in ecstasy.
This is Other Worlds on Earth, a radio show of unapologetic romanticism and utopian yearning for people with unlimited vision. Expect deep dives into counterculture, counterhistory, altered states, ethnobotany, radical anthropology, esoteric explorations, and Other Worlds on Earth. I've been fascinated by cannabis for a while. The breadth of knowledge, traditions, and history around cannabis is so massive that no one person could possibly know everything about it. And so in the next hour, I will not attempt to summarize all of that, because nobody could. I will give you a small sample of some of my thoughts and inspirations about it, it being the month of April and the annual high holiday of 420 is fast approaching. If you're uninterested in cannabis or drugs in general, I still think you may find this episode entertaining, and maybe even enlightening. I watched the movie Free Solo, about the climber Alex Honnold scaling magnificent rock faces with no ropes or other protective equipment. Neither before the movie, nor after it, did I have any desire to risk my life just to say I climbed an insane height. And yet I thoroughly enjoyed the movie, and recommended it to others. As an initial jumping-off point, I'd like to read some thoughts on cannabis from Carl Sagan, the famed public science educator and creator of the TV series Cosmos. I've read a lot about cannabis, and this is one of the most thoughtful, entertaining, and all-around best descriptions of the cannabis experience I've ever been exposed to. It also is not very well known, so it's unlikely you've ever heard it before. So let's get started. It all began about 10 years ago. I had reached a considerably more relaxed period in my life, a time when I had come to feel there was more to living than science, a time of awakening of my social consciousness and amiability, a time when I was open to new experiences. I had become friendly with a group of people who occasionally smoked cannabis, irregularly, but with evident pleasure. Initially, I was unwilling to partake, but the apparent euphoria that cannabis produced and the fact there was no physiological addiction to the plant eventually persuaded me to try. My initial experiences were entirely disappointing. There was no effect at all, and I began to entertain a variety of hypotheses about cannabis being a placebo, which worked by expectation and hyperventilation rather than by chemistry. After about 5 or 6 unsuccessful attempts, however, it happened. I was lying on my back in a friend's living room, idly examining the pattern of shadows on the ceiling cast by a potted plant, not cannabis. I suddenly realized I was examining an intricately detailed miniature Volkswagen, distinctly outlined by the shadows. I was very skeptical at this perception and tried to find inconsistencies between Volkswagens and what I viewed on the ceiling. But it was all there, down to the hubcaps, license plate, chrome, and even the small handle used for opening the trunk. When I closed my eyes, I was stunned to find that there was a movie going on in the inside of my eyelids. Flash, a simple country scene with red farmhouse, a blue sky, white clouds, yellow path meandering over green hills to the horizon. Flash, same scene, orange house, brown sky, red clouds, yellow path, violet fields. Flash, flash, flash. The flashes came about once a heartbeat. Each flash brought the same simple scene into view, but each time with a different set of colors. Exquisitely deep hues and astonishingly harmonious in their juxtaposition. Since then, I have smoked occasionally and enjoyed it thoroughly. It amplifies torpid sensibilities and produces what to me are even more interesting effects, as I will explain shortly. I can remember another early visual experience with cannabis, in which I viewed a candle flame and discovered in the heart of the flame, standing with magnificent indifference, the black-hatted and cloaked Spanish gentleman who appears on the label of the Sandeman sherry bottle. Looking at fires when high, by the way, especially through one of those prism kaleidoscopes which image their surroundings, is an extraordinarily moving and beautiful experience. I want to explain that at no time did I think these things were really out there. I knew there was no Volkswagen on the ceiling, and there was no Sandeman Salamander Man in the flame. I don't feel any contradiction in these experiences. There's a part of me creating the perceptions, which in everyday life would be bizarre. There's another part of me, which is a kind of observer. About half of the pleasure comes from the observer part, appreciating the work of the creator part. I smile, or sometimes even laugh out loud at the pictures on the inside of my eyelids. In this sense, I suppose cannabis is a psychomimetic, but I find none of the panic or terror that accompanies some psychoses. Possibly this is because I know it's my own trip, and that I can come down rapidly anytime I want to. While my early perceptions were all visual and curiously lacking images of human beings, both of these items have changed over the intervening years. I find that today a single joint is enough to get me high. I test whether I'm high by closing my eyes and looking for the flashes. They come long before there are any alterations in my visual or other perceptions. I would guess this is a signal-to-noise problem, the visual noise level being very low with my eyes closed. Another interesting information theoretical aspect is the prevalence, at least in my flashed images, of cartoons. Just the outlines of figures, caricatures, not photographs. I think this is simply a matter of information compression. It would be impossible to grasp the total content of an image with the information content of an ordinary photograph, say 108 bits, in the fraction of a second which a flash occupies. And the flash experience is designed, if I may use that word, for instant appreciation. The artist and the viewer are one. This is not to say the images are not marvelously detailed and complex. I recently had an image in which two people were talking, and the words they were saying would form and disappear in yellow above their heads, at about a sentence per heartbeat. In this way, it was possible to follow the conversation. At the same time, an occasional word would appear in red letters among the yellows above their head, perfectly in context with the conversation. But if one remembered these red words, they would enunciate a quite different set of statements, penetratingly critical of the conversation. The entire image set, which I've outlined here, with, I would say, at least 100 yellow words and something like 10 red words, occurred in something under a minute. The cannabis experience has greatly improved my appreciation for art, a subject which I had never much appreciated before. The understanding of the intent of the artist, which I can achieve when high, sometimes carries over to when I'm down. This is one of many human frontiers which cannabis has helped me traverse. There are also some art-related insights. I don't know whether they are true or false, but they were fun to formulate. For example, I have spent some time high looking at the work of Belgian surrealist Yves Tanguy. Some years later, I emerged from a long swim in the Caribbean and sank exhausted onto a beach formed from the erosion of a nearby coral reef. In idly examining the arcuate pastel-colored coral fragments which made up the beach, I saw before me a vast Tanguy painting. Perhaps Tanguy visited such a beach in his childhood. A very similar improvement in my appreciation of music has occurred with cannabis. For the first time, I have been able to hear the separate parts of a three-part harmony and the richness of the counterpoint. I have since discovered that professional musicians can quite easily keep many separate parts going simultaneously in their heads, but this is a first time for me. Again, the learning experience when high has at least to some extent carried over when I'm down. The enjoyment of food is amplified, tastes and aromas emerge that for some reason we ordinarily seem too busy to notice. I'm able to give my full attention to the sensation. A potato will have a texture, a body, and a taste like that of other potatoes, but much more so. Cannabis also enhances the enjoyment of sex. On the one hand, it gives an exquisite sensitivity, but on the other hand, it postpones orgasm, in part by distracting me with the profusion of images passing before my eyes. The actual duration of orgasm seems to lengthen greatly, but this may be the usual experience of time expansion, which comes with cannabis smoking. I do not consider myself a religious person in the usual sense, but there is a religious aspect to some highs. The heightened sensitivity in all areas gives me a feeling of communion with my surroundings, both animate and inanimate. Sometimes a kind of existential perception of the absurd comes over me, and I see with awful certainty the hypocrisies and posturing of myself and my fellow men. And at other times, there's a different sense of the absurd, a playful and whimsical awareness. Both of these senses of the absurd can be communicated, and some of the most rewarding highs I've had have been in sharing talk and perceptions and humor. Cannabis brings us an awareness that we spend a lifetime being trained to overlook and forget and put out of our minds. A sense of what the world is really like can be maddening. Cannabis has brought me some feelings for what it is like to be crazy, and how we use that word crazy to avoid thinking about things that are too painful for us. In the Soviet Union, political dissidents are routinely placed in insane asylums. The same kind of thing, a little more subtle perhaps, occurs here. Did you hear what Lenny Bruce said yesterday? He must be crazy. When high on cannabis, I discovered there's somebody inside those people we call mad. When I'm high, I can penetrate into the past, recall childhood memories, friends, relatives, playthings, streets, smells, sounds, and tastes from a vanished era. I can reconstruct the actual occurrences and childhood events only half understood at the time. Many but not all my cannabis trips have somewhere in them a symbolism significant to me, which I won't attempt to describe here, a kind of mandala embossed on the high, free associating to this mandala, both visually and as plays on words, has produced a very rich array of insights. There is a myth about such highs. The user has an illusion of great insight, but it does not survive scrutiny in the morning. I am convinced this is an error, and that the devastating insights achieved when high are real insights. The main problem is putting these insights in a form acceptable to the quite different self that we are when we're down the next day. Some of the hardest work I've ever done has been to put such insights down on tape or in writing. The problem is that 10 even more interesting ideas or images have to be lost in the effort of recording one. It is easy to understand why someone might think it's a waste of effort going to all that trouble to set the thought down, a kind of intrusion of the Protestant ethic. But since I live almost all my life down, I've made the effort successfully, I think. Incidentally, I find that reasonably good insights can be remembered the next day, but only if some effort has been made to set them down another way. If I write the insight down or tell it to someone, then I can remember it with no assistance the following morning. But if I merely say to myself that I must make an effort to remember, I never do. I find that most of the insights I achieve when high are into social issues, an area of creative scholarship very different from the one I'm generally known for. I can remember at one occasion, taking a shower with my wife while high, in which I had an idea on the origins and invalidities of racism in terms of Gaussian distribution curves. It was a point obvious in a way, but rarely talked about. I drew the curves in soap on the shower wall and went to write the idea down. One idea led to another, and at the end of about an hour of extremely hard work, I found I had written 11 short essays on a wide range of social, political, philosophical, and human biological topics. Because of problems of space, I can't go into the details of these essays. But from all external signs, such as public reactions and expert commentary, they seem to contain valid insights. I have used them in university commencement addresses, public lectures, and in my books. But let me try to at least give the flavor of such an insight and its accompaniments. One night, high on cannabis, I was delving into my childhood, a little self-analysis, and making what seemed to me very good progress. I then paused and thought how extraordinary it was that Sigmund Freud, with no assistance from drugs, had been able to achieve his own remarkable self-analysis. But then it hit me, like a thunderclap, that this was wrong. That Freud had spent the decade before his self-analysis as an experimenter with and a proselytizer for cocaine. And it seemed to me very apparent that the genuine psychological insights that Freud brought to the world were at least in part derived from his drug experience. I have no idea whether this is in fact true, or whether the historians of Freud would agree with this interpretation, or even if such an idea has been published in the past, but it is an interesting hypothesis and one which passes first scrutiny in the world of the Downs. I can remember the night that I suddenly realized what it would be like to be crazy, or nights when my feelings and perceptions were of a religious nature. I had a very accurate sense that these feelings and perceptions, written down casually, would not stand the usual critical scrutiny that is my stock in trade as a scientist. If I find in the morning a message from myself, the night before, informing me that there is a world around us which we barely sense, or that we can become one with the universe, or even that certain politicians are desperately frightened men, I may tend to disbelieve. But when I'm high, I know about this disbelief. And so I have a tape in which I exhort myself to take such remarks seriously. I say, listen closely, you son of a bitch of the morning. This stuff is real. I try to show that my mind is working clearly. I recall the name of a high school acquaintance I have not thought of in 30 years. I describe the color, typography, and format of a book in another room. And these memories do pass critical scrutiny in the morning. I am convinced that there are genuine and valid levels of perception available with cannabis, and probably with other drugs, which are, through the defects of our society and our educational system, unavailable to us without such drugs. Such a remark applies not only to self-awareness and to intellectual pursuits, but also to perceptions of real people. A vastly enhanced sensitivity to facial expression, intonations, and choice of words, which sometimes yields a rapport so close it's as if two people are reading each other's minds. Cannabis enables non-musicians to know a little about what it's like to be a musician, and non-artists to grasp the joys of art. But I am neither an artist nor a musician. What about my own scientific work? While I find a curious disinclination to think of my professional concerns when high, the attractive intellectual adventures always seem to be in every other area. I have made a conscious effort to think of a few particularly difficult current problems in my field when high. It works, at least to a degree. I find I can bring to bear, for example, a range of relevant experimental facts which appear to be mutually inconsistent. So far, so good. At least the recall works. Then in trying to conceive of a way of reconciling the disparate facts, I was able to come up with a very bizarre possibility, one that I'm sure I would never have thought of when down. I've written a paper which mentions this idea in passing. I think it's very unlikely to be true, but it has consequences which are experimentally testable, which is the hallmark of an acceptable theory. I have mentioned that in the cannabis experience, there is a part of your mind that remains a dispassionate observer, who is able to take you down in a hurry if need be. I have on a few occasions been forced to drive in heavy traffic when high. I've negotiated it with no difficulty at all, though I did have some thoughts about the marvelous cherry red color of traffic lights. I find that after the drive, I'm not high at all. There are no flashes on the inside of my eyelids. If you're high and your child is calling, you can respond about as capably as you usually do. I don't advocate driving when high on cannabis, but I can tell you from personal experience that it certainly can be done. My high is always reflective, peaceable, intellectually exciting, and sociable, unlike most alcohol highs, and there is never a hangover. Through the years, I find that slightly smaller amounts of cannabis suffice to produce the same degree of high, and in one movie theater recently, I found I could get high just by inhaling the cannabis smoke which permeated the theater. There is a very nice self-teetering aspect to cannabis. Each puff is a very small dose. The time lag between inhaling a puff and sensing its effect is small. And there is no desire for more after the high is there. I think the ratio, R, of the time to sense the dose taken to the time required to take an excessive dose is an important quantity. R is very large for LSD, which I've never taken, and reasonably short for cannabis. Small amounts of R should be one measure of the safety of psychedelic drugs. When cannabis is legalized, I hope to see this ratio as one of the parameters printed on the pack. I hope that time isn't too distant. The illegality of cannabis is outrageous, an impediment to full utilization of a drug which helps produce the serenity and insight, sensitivity and fellowship so desperately needed in this increasingly mad and dangerous world. That was Carl Sagan speaking about the pleasures and mysteries of cannabis. His essay was published under the pen name Mr. X in the book Marijuana Reconsidered by Lester Grinspoon. Lester Grinspoon was a pioneering cannabis researcher and a friend of Sagan. Carl Sagan was reportedly an enthusiastic user of cannabis his whole life, but never spoke publicly about his experience under his real name for fear of repercussions to his work, family, and the ability to be a respected public voice. Carl did openly speak out against nuclear weapons and the effect society was having on the environment, but he never touched the drug issue. It's unfortunate not only for him, but also for all of us, because it was clearly a topic he was interested in, and I imagine, if there had been less social taboo around the subject, he quite likely would have engaged in drug research and public education about it. Years after his death, his son acknowledged that Carl was Mr. X. If you watch his TV series Cosmos or read any of his work, you'll clearly hear his voice in this essay. The wonder, the awe, the spiritual connection to the plant. There's so much I like about this essay. He speaks of feeling communion with his surroundings, becoming one with the universe. Despite being an avowed atheist, he was not immune to flirtations with notions like this, which you also find in Cosmos. Despite him giving a resounding no to the formalized God question, one might say he had a certain spiritual yearning, even if it didn't extend beyond his own personal interest in a kind of myth-making or meaning-making, and even if those myths and those meanings were about things like the collective human spirit or understanding our place in the universe. If you watch Cosmos, you find that he really wants you to see, to understand, to grapple with the fact that we're all just tiny pieces in a much larger whole. We're part of something much larger than ourselves. How we choose to understand that is up to us. My favorite parts of Cosmos, though, are the Earth-centered parts. He is in no way stuck in the stars or dismissive of Earth, which he faithfully paints as an almost impossibly perfect and peaceful place to live. In the essay I read, he also gives quite a lot of attention to the wilder aspects of the experience. He speaks of time dilation, of intricate closed and open-eye visuals, including mandalas that imbue an ineffable but personal significance. These effects, coupled with the exploration of the spiritual, or as he calls it, the religious nature of the experience, might surprise some listeners. Are you sure he's talking about pot? Are you sure his dealer isn't dipping those joints in some diluted LSD? When I first became interested in cannabis years ago, I reported rather similar descriptions of the effects to friends, who mostly didn't identify with it. And you don't really see those effects talked about much in the cannabis culture either. The image painted is more of a combination relaxant euphoriant that makes you giggle and gives you the munchies. In other words, the Cheech and Chong influence on how we understand cannabis. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Those effects are real, and all well and good. But why is there little talk about things like increased pattern recognition and the more psychedelic effects? Beyond the Cheech and Chong influence, I think that regular daily users of cannabis may have a high tolerance and thus be blunted from some of the more interesting aspects of the experience. And also many occasional users may consume a smaller dose, like someone who occasionally drinks and does not drink to the point of unchained drunkenness, but just enough to get a slight buzz. But there is another world beyond the buzz, and it's high time the so-called classical psychedelics like mushrooms and acid stop holding a cultural monopoly on how to access that world, or at least touch the edges of it. All I know is that the more I read about cannabis and the more people I talked to, the more reports I found that overlapped more with my experience. They were harder to find, but I knew I wasn't alone when I read the words of Carl Sagan. And also, in Charles T. Tart's classic book from 1969, Altered States of Consciousness, he includes another anonymously written essay on the effects of marijuana, which is categorized in the book as a minor psychedelic drug. The essay speaks of the visual effects, the increased pattern recognition, and rather dramatic time distortion that went beyond my own experiences with the time dilation effect, which personally never went beyond time appearing 1.5 times slower. While minor has a connotation of lesser, the classification of marijuana as a minor psychedelic drug feels roughly accurate. The essay in this book also speaks, like Sagan does, of the increased appreciation for music, and addresses the question of different people experiencing different effects. Quote, "For a person using marijuana for the first few times, sensory changes occur sequentially rather than all at once. First, he may notice increased brightness and clarity of colors, then sounds, then visual structures such as paintings or designs. Two-dimensional photographs and motion pictures may be seen in three dimensions in the marijuana high, a perception which can be transferred to the normal state under certain conditions. Then proprioceptive sensations may present themselves. Any order of the effects may occur during one high state or several. Often effects will develop to a particular level and then stabilize without further elaboration. I know some individuals who listen to music during a high, and this is their major use and apparently their only enhancement." This reminds me of a marvelously entertaining chapter in a book by Hector France called Musk, Hashish, and Blood from 1900. He describes entering a kind of hashish den in Athens, Greece. One choice, quote, "I experienced an unspeakable pleasure in listening to the wild, barbaric music. I seemed to be watching a series of marvelous arabesques in the utmost complexity standing out in relief, with an astonishing intensity of tone and an incomparable brilliancy of color on a background of fresh lime wash that covered the cracks and stains of a crumbling wall." I don't mean to suggest that my own experiences were akin to a full-blown psilocybin mushroom trip, nor do I mean to suggest it's the same effects, but merely less intense, which would suggest a dose-dependent way in which they could be identical. They're not the same, but there's some overlap. But all these substances, while they have the feeling of existing in the same universe, express themselves differently and have their own unique properties and character. So far, I've been limiting myself to discussion of cannabis as experienced through inhalation. It is a bit more popularly known, however, that an even more powerful and psychedelic effect can be obtained by eating cannabis preparations. With this method of ingestion in mind, we're able to find many historical accounts going back a long time describing wild, incredible, and/or terrifying trips that have a character indistinguishable from the so-called major psychedelics. We can find some of these accounts among the writings of members of a Paris group called Club des Hashishin, which met in the 1840s and included such names as Victor Hugo, Alexandre Dumas, Gustave Flaubert, and Charles Baudelaire. The cannabis preparations they consumed were always in edible form. Back then, where cannabis existed in the West, this is how it was taken. Indeed, this was likely the dominant form of ingestion for thousands of years across the globe. The concept of smoking anything is relatively recent in the West, and probably relatively recent in general. The question of who smoked something, anything, first, is a bit up for debate, though. Some historians talk of American indigenous groups who used tobacco being the inventors of smoking. However, in East Asia, there's a long history of smoking opium. How the practice of smoking a psychoactive substance first became known in the West, and from whom, is a bit unclear. On the other side of the pond, in Schenectady, New York, in 1857, Fitzhugh Ludlow published a groundbreaking work titled The Hashish Eater. I'm not sure if Ludlow was aware of the Club des Hashishin, existing a decade earlier, but we know he was greatly inspired by the English Thomas de Quincey's Confessions of an English Opium Eater from 1821. In The Hashish Eater, Ludlow gives the most mind-bending, world and time-traveling, and frankly, a bit unbelievable description of the cannabis experience you could ever imagine. I highly recommend reading at least the first quarter of the book, which is immensely fanciful and entertaining. The rest of the book seemed a bit unnecessary. But here's one of many amazing passages in the book, read by the irreplaceable psychedelic missionary, Terence McKenna.
This next vision illustrated both, but especially the latter of these laws. The temple doors opened noiselessly before me, but it was no sense of sublimity which thus broke in upon my eyes. I stood in a large apartment which resembled the Senate chamber at Washington more than anything else to which I can compare it. Its roof was vaulted, and at the side opposite the entrance, the floor rose into a dais surrounded by a large armchair. The body of the house was occupied by similar chairs disposed in arcs. The heavy paneling of the walls was adorned with grotesque frescoes of every imaginable bird, beast, and monster, which, by some hidden law of life and motion, were forever changing, like the figures of the kaleidoscope. Now the walls bristled with hippogriffs. Now, from wainscot to ceiling, toucans and macatas swung and nodded from their perches amid emerald palms. Now centaurs and lepenthe clashed in ferocious tumult, while crater and cyanthus were crushed beneath ringing hoof and heel. But my attention was quickly distracted from the frescoes by the sight of a most witchly congress, which filled all the chairs of that broad chamber. On the dais sat an old crone whose commanding position first engaged my attention to her personal appearance, and, upon rather impolite scrutiny, I beheld that she was the product of an art held in preeminent favor among persons of her age and sex. She was knit of purple yarn. In faultless order, the stitches ran along her face. In every pucker of her retrenchant mouth, in every wrinkle of her brow, she was a yarny counterfeit of the grand dame of actual life, and by some skillful process of stuffing her nose, had received its due peak and her chin its projection. The occupants of the seats below were all but reproductions of their president. Both she and they were constantly swaying from side to side, forward and back, to the music of some invisible instruments whose tone and style were most intensely and ludicrously Ethiopian. Not a word was spoken by any of the woolly conclave, but with untiring industry they were all knitting, knitting, knitting ceaselessly, as if their lives depended upon it. I looked to see the objects of their manufacture. They were knitting old women like themselves. One of the sisterhood had nearly brought her double to completion. Earnestly, another was engaged in rounding out an eyeball. Another was fastening the gathers at the corners of a mouth. Another was setting up stitches for an old woman in petto. With marvelous rapidity, this work went on. Ever and anon, some completed crone sprang from the needles which had just achieved her, and instantly vivified, took up the instruments of reproduction, and fell to work as assiduously as if she had been a member of the Congress since the world began. Here, I cried, here at last do I realize the meaning of endless progression. And through the dome echoed my peals of laughter. I saw no motion of astonishment in the stitches of a single face, but as for dear life, the manufacture of old women went on unobstructed by the involuntary rudeness of the stranger. An irresistible desire to aid in the work possessed me. I was half determined to snatch up a quartet of needles and join the sisterhood. My nose began to be ruffled with stitches, and the next moment I had been a partner in their yarny destinies, but for a hand which pulled me backward through the door and shut the Congress forever from my view.
The first time I got high, it was on an overall low dose of orally taken cannabis oil, for which I, of course, had no tolerance. At one point, I became incredibly tired and laid down on the bed, closing my eyes. I watched cartoonish black-and-white figures being drawn on my eyelids and becoming animated in a jumpy flipbook kind of way. I instinctively thought, I can't believe they legalized this! Which brings me back to Carl Sagan's experience, which is certainly a bit more pronounced than my own, despite my ability to identify with so much of it. One thing he comments on is the cartoon-like nature of the visuals, When I first read this, it's something I really latched onto, because I too had noticed that marijuana seemed to encourage cartoon visuals more than other more intense psychedelic substances. The world also feels more cartoon-like, and the humor-inducing effect is well known. There's a kind of childlike playfulness, which other substances can certainly engender, but not in quite the same cartoony way. Much like the impulse of many psychedelic enthusiasts to explain the birth of various religions with early psychedelic visions, I had a more modest but maybe even more crackpot idea. Is cannabis responsible for cartoons? Were the earliest cartoons the result of the artists attempting to draw their visions? The term cartoon is a bit hazy, especially historically. But for the purposes of what I'm talking about here, when I say cartoon, I'm referring to the more obviously cartoony animations. So characters like Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny, you know, cartoony. So what was the first animated cartoon? As far as I can tell, the first one was made in 1908 by the French artist Emile Cole, entitled Phantasmagorie. You can watch it on YouTube. It's only a couple minutes long. The film consists of a series of simple drawn images of a series of objects continually transforming into one another. First, there's a wine bottle, which then morphs into a flower, then into an elephant, and so on. There was certainly bizarre and surrealistic art which predated this work, but they had never been animated before. There's a certain added trippiness to animated cartoons, which I think is quite evident in Phantasmagorie. Real hallucinations are rarely static images, but moving, transforming ones. My biggest evidence of the cartoon cannabis connection, though, is that a couple years later, in 1910, Cole came out with another animated cartoon called The Hasher's Delirium, literally illustrating a character staring at what appears to be a white orb on the wall, in which he has a series of morphing visions ranging from the strange to the terrifying. This is also on YouTube, in case you want to watch it. It goes to show I'm not imagining this medium being trippy with the first cartoons. The father of the animated cartoon clearly leaned into this explicitly. I searched through a biography of Emile Cole for any mention of cannabis, hashish, drugs, any kind of evidence that he had visionary experiences which may have influenced his animation. Disappointingly, I couldn't find anything. Emile Cole was involved with avant-garde movements at the time, encountering many people and things that were not mainstream. Given the history of hashish use in France starting at least a few decades prior to this, in circles similar to the ones he moved in, it's altogether possible Cole had first-hand experience. Admittedly, as I said before, this is a bit of a flimsy crackpot theory, but if there's any truth to it, it would mean that the larger cultural influence of cartoony visions and humorous anti-logic are essentially a generalized drug hallucination, extracted originally from this artist's altered state and essentially psychedelicizing all derivative works going up to today. I'm not convinced there's anything essentially inevitable or natural about the way animated cartoons are. They could have easily been very different or not existed in any meaningfully similar way at all, were it not for these first works setting a certain tone for what they should be like. It matters what comes first, what sets the initial tone, the initial premise. I read an interesting thing from the famous neurologist Oliver Sacks, in which he was discussing Charles Bonnet syndrome, which is a condition that occurs typically in some older people, particularly with those with failing vision. The hallmark symptom is frequent silent hallucinations, which can have remarkable vividness and complexity. There's often images of faces or people who are often dressed very elaborately in bright, fantastic colors. That may sound rather specific, but there really are many people that see people in elaborate, colorful dress. The people with this condition are otherwise mentally healthy, do not have other conditions like schizophrenia, and are very aware that the hallucinations are hallucinations, rather than materially real things they need to fear. One of the theories is that as their eyesight fails, the brain tries to fill in the gaps with expectations of what people should be perceiving. Why the visions are not more mundane is a bit unclear. The most common thing people see is faces, sometimes deformed faces, and the second most common is cartoons. They essentially run like a film in part of the person's vision, as a regular daily occurrence.
There is another part of the brain which is especially activated when one sees cartoons. It's activated when one recognizes cartoons, when one draws cartoons, or when one hallucinates them. It's very interesting that that should be specific.
So is there something particularly special about cartoons? Are they archetypes from somewhere deep within our subconscious, something that all of us innately have within us? It's easy to conclude that the reason Carl Sagan or anyone after him would hallucinate cartoons is because they've watched cartoons before. Everyone knows what they look like. So in a dreamlike manner, you have that material to draw on if you're having drug-induced visions. But what I'm getting at here is maybe cartoons represent something more special, inherent, that we always had but usually didn't have access to, except with certain types of experiences, special tools to help us unlock that part of ourselves. A part we get to activate and experience now across all of society because of the invention of the animated cartoon. And when we see that animated cartoon, our consciousness gets it, understands it in a way that's deeper and easier than the way we understand, say, an electrical circuit breaker. Maybe it was waiting there in us all along, and because this artistic medium didn't exist yet, we didn't know we had this commonality. It's a bit of a chicken or the egg problem, but you've got to admit, a rather entertaining one. A few years ago, I heard an interesting story on a radio station out of Vermont. Cannabis had been going through a very slow legalization process in Vermont, and one of the phases it had entered at the time of this story was one in which possession and growing of cannabis was legalized, but selling it was still illegal. Vermont is a very rural, farming and gardening-oriented state. So when this phase started and it was announced in the media, a lot of people tried growing weed largely for the novelty of growing a new plant that they'd never grown and before hadn't been allowed to. This included plenty of people across the age spectrum who were sometimes totally unfamiliar with cannabis, but liked gardening and experimenting with new plants. So they grew it, they harvested it, and they read tutorials online about how to dry and cure it. And then many who hadn't tried it before tried it. Some liked it, some didn't. But the main interesting thing this resulted in was a huge excess of unwanted cannabis. There was simply too much of it around. The journalist reporting this story said that just that week, 10 different people she knew had offered her weed for free, as there was just such an abundance of it, and also, they couldn't sell it, at least not legally. And as I said, many people were growing it for the novelty of it, and were not necessarily already regular users, nor were they criminally inclined. So lots of people who weren't interested in breaking drug laws had pounds and pounds of this drug they weren't that interested in, or even if they were, simply had too much of. What had been temporarily birthed here was an unintentional gift economy, created by legal and cultural circumstance. I thought this was rather incredible. I went online to see if there was more information about this situation in Vermont, and instead discovered that the same situation had been happening in many other places which had this staggered introduction of legalization. For a time, people in Portland, Oregon could only legally obtain cannabis as a gift, which was celebrated at the Burnside Burn Rally, where big crowds lit up together and shared what they had. For a time, a similar situation also transpired in California, Maine, and Massachusetts. A similar situation continues in Washington, D.C. Back in Vermont, some of the people who grew all this cannabis also owned farms, so they came up with an idea for selling, but not really selling, their stash. Since they were already selling fruits and vegetables at roadside stands and farmers' markets, some farmers started including cannabis as a free gift alongside other purchases. While clever, this idea did undermine the truly free gift economy of weed there. The same basic system has become practically institutionalized in Washington, D.C., which voted to legalize cannabis across the board, but has remained in this legal limbo where gifting is the only permitted form of exchange due to the unique legal circumstances of D.C., and its conflict with Congress over cannabis law. Cannabis businesses in D.C. for several years now operate in a strange gray area where they sell cheap merchandise like t-shirts, coffee mugs, and keychains, for exorbitant prices. Prices which include the cost of the included free gift of cannabis. This, unfortunately, is pretty far from a true gift, but nevertheless, the seed of an interesting idea is here in all these places where this situation happened, even if it wasn't intentional. Often the best ideas and most interesting ones are not intentional. The initial situation in Vermont in particular made me wonder what it would be like if more things were legal to self-produce and gift, but illegal to sell. In a microcosm, isn't this a form of the anti-capitalist dream? A true gift economy of people exchanging goods based on need and desire in joyful abundance? Not for money, not for barter, but just freely given. And in a gift economy, the reason you give away the things you produce isn't purely altruistic, but because you greedily want all the other free stuff others are giving away. The greedy freeloader gets the most bang for their gifts in such a situation. Think about how much work you have to do to produce the money necessary to obtain all the necessities and pleasures of life. And it's often not enough for so many. A true community is one not atomized and segregated, where everyone is individually slaving away at their individual jobs, but instead working together with their neighbors for the maximization of joy and the minimization of work. A recognition of our obvious interdependence rather than a constant illogical denial of it. The so-called tragedy of the commons is a myth propagated by right-wingers to get us to consistently not believe in our own power and the power of cooperation. The story is that things held in common ultimately aren't well taken care of because nobody truly owns it, like how some people own their house. People's selfish interests get in the way of the common good. Thus, it's better for everyone if, ideally, nothing is held in common, and private individuals and corporations are responsible for all the land, buildings, farms, etc. Nonsense. Pure propaganda from the tiny class of people constantly and truly scheming to suck all the wealth from this planet and its people. Us. We can't be trusted to take care of each other, to take care of our wealth, to take care of this planet. So they, the CEOs, the politicians, they need to do it for us. It's of course merely a coincidence that these are the same people in control of almost all the wealth, the people running the mechanisms of exploitation which extract every bit of value from our labor, all the while telling us we're not working hard enough and selling us on the next labor-saving device which is supposed to alleviate the need for so much work. But of course, every single time is really just a cover for working at least the same amount but with greater efficiency to produce more value for the bosses with no additional workers, or ideally, even less of them. The real tragedy of the commons is the tragedy of the transfer of the commons into private, profit-driven hands who want to sell back to humanity what should be its birthright. If we look around society, can we find other places where the ancient practice of the gift persists? One example that came to my mind is graffiti. Graffiti is not a gift in the traditional sense of something given from one person to another. In fact, it's even more generous than that. Graffiti artists are not remunerated and are almost always anonymous, so you can't pay back your debt to them for their artistic public service, even if you wanted to. Much like sideshows, the outlaw auto shows that take over intersections, which I talked about in the last episode of this show, graffiti takes work, investment, and involves real legal risk. It is an artistic gift, not to any one person, but to all of us. Not all artists have equal talent, and not everybody likes every piece of art. But don't let the illegality of it fool you. This is true of legal art as well, and a lot of that, you also have little individual say in how you experience it. Moreover, probably most graffiti, which is of poor craftsmanship, is simply a reflection of its illegality. Sometimes artists, forced to work under the cover of darkness and with the looming threat of arrest, make their art quicker than they'd prefer to. But graffiti is public art. It is a gift not to any single person, but a gift to us all. Rejection of it is informed by the dominator society's values, which reject or views as suspect everything that isn't a commodity. The reaction some people have toward graffiti that they'd never have toward permitted art, no matter how atrocious it is, proves these opinions are not logical, and the values that inform them are not intuitive natural reactions, but ones which are learned, taught. Why does society want to teach us something like graffiti is bad, rather than an art medium that could be valuable to us? Why is it not to be appreciated alongside other art commissioned and paid for by the city? Because the subtext is that the only value that matters is the capitalist concept of value. Graffiti doesn't have any of that. Even if we're evaluating the exact same activity, the permitted form is considered creation, while the unpermitted form is considered destruction. This is why some graffiti artists paint over permitted public art. It's not necessarily the art itself being opposed, although what gets approved is often terrible, but it's the permission they rightfully resent, the control, and the permitted public art represents that control. It's one of many reminders to us that we as individuals, as a community, are not in control of our environment. It's not our Edenic playground, as it should be. There's a watchtower, a foot patrol, a hall monitor, watching us and asking us to please move along swiftly between work and home in an orderly fashion. It's worth discussing the concept of escapism a bit, since we've been talking about altered states and the cannabis experience in particular. One of the accusations lobbed at the drug experience by its opponents is that it's escapist. Escapism is used here, obviously, with a negative connotation. But why should it be? What's wrong with escaping mental states or physical places, temporarily or permanently? This is often equated with the practice some have of chronically running away from problems which only get worse or continually reproduce themselves as they're never fully dealt with. But that would be a rather subjective and thus not universal manifestation of escape, which is particular to certain specific people's circumstances. It makes no sense to have a more universal list of activities scornfully called escapist. What, in essence, is the difference between escapism and adventure? The difference is how valuable or positive the activity appears to be in the eye of the beholder. In political circles, there is not only often negative labeling of some activities or projects as escapist, but also as adventurist, which has a similar negative connotation. But more generally speaking, adventure tends to have a more universally positive connotation. Escapism may get a bad rap, but isn't it understandable why people would want to escape? And isn't it interesting to be able to explore new worlds other than the ones we're familiar with? A form of this, which has become ritualized in Western culture, is the summer vacation. Leaving aside the overly commercialized aspects of it, which are many, at base, the ritual of escaping the daily grind for as long as possible to commune with nature and explore other cultures is an interesting form of nomadic revivalism. Even within the hyper-commercialized aspects of this vacation culture is an unabashed glorification of leisure and avoidance of work. Nobody walks around a beach or a summer camp accusing people of being lazy. Being lazy is the whole point. We're given far too little opportunity for being unproductive, and short of a generalized revolt against work, these times of the year are some of the only times many of us get to temporarily escape many of our legally enforced obligations. We can also look at examples of what you could call physical manifestations of escapism, like the commune movement and present-day intentional communities. Not to mention the intentional communities slash communes, which have existed for longer than those terms, the various religious groups which have set up and maintained communities as far outside of mainstream society as possible. The chief examples of this in the U.S. and Canada are the various Anabaptist offshoots like the Amish and the Hutterites, who are the closest living relative to the more radical movements that emerged during the Radical Reformation in the 1500s. They are microcosms of utopian communist living experiments which have endured. The more religiously driven experiments tended to have a better shot at staying together on average. There are also, of course, ways of escaping into inner space, the hallmark example being drug-induced altered states. It's important to be able to really think outside the box, and altered states definitely afford that opportunity. They put you in a different headspace, sometimes dramatically so, than the one you're usually in. And this can allow you to help imagine other worlds, other ways of being, And this to me is the political value of altered states. But politics aside, I also see seeking to alter consciousness as a pretty universal human endeavor that's been going on for thousands of years. All those people, for all those centuries, weren't all simply wasting time, which is usually defined as something akin to procrastinating filing your taxes. Anything that breaks up the routine could be viewed as escapism, but do you really need to be staying in the same routines, same places, doing the same things, only making small improvements on them, or else you're being escapist in a negative sense? Isn't doing practically anything enjoyable that's different from your daily routine escapism? In revolutionary movements, escapism is often used derisively. So what if we view the establishment of alternative communities and institutions as a waste of time, and are completely focused on how to change the big picture to change everything? In other words, to foment revolution. In order to know how to change everything, to know what those big goals should look like, what the future world should look like, in order to foment revolution, you need to foment the imagination. Isn't it important to escape sometimes? See how people live in other worlds on Earth? And also, shouldn't we not be limited to the ones that already exist, or already have existed in history, but be seeking to create new and better worlds that have never existed? It's going to take quite a lot of imagination and experimentation to successfully escape the world we don't want. And the task amounts to nothing less than a global social awakening of consciousness, a global altered state, a utopian high that never ends. There are many ways to alter your state of consciousness. You can use a plant like cannabis, have a meal when hungry, listen to music, meditate, plunge into icy water. I'm not being facetious. All of these things change your mental and physical state, and all of them have the capacity to do it quite dramatically. One concept I truly feel should be more widely applied from the psychedelic world is that of set and setting. This is mostly known as a simplified guide for positive psychedelic trips, and an acknowledgement that the experience is greatly influenced by the mindset you go into it with, and the setting around you when you do. But this is really true of all substances, and more broadly, all activities. So your set and setting for, say, an exercise session could lead you to potentially liberating revelations and feelings. But if you're distracting yourself the whole time from the session by listening to an audiobook or perhaps even this very radio show, you may not fully appreciate the potential the experience has to offer. In the age of tech startups and their cult of so-called disruption, the old phrase, thinking outside the box, might sound a bit trite and worn out, but that's exactly what we need to do. Except we need to think way outside the box. We need to imagine new worlds so startlingly different from the ones we inhabit most of the time that they may even scare us a bit. We need to cultivate ideas of freedom and communion so far-reaching and countercultural that once you know them, you cannot unknow them. We need discourses and practices so inspiring and transcendent that one day no one will be able to believe that at one time so many people were convinced that this world was the only one possible, until some of us dared to break the spell.